I do believe today that designers are content creators. And as content creators, one of your main tasks is to tell a story in a format that is compelling to an audience. Like, I think the best designers are probably like TikTok creators within their own company who can create some ad idea that's sticky and really engaging in a way that's really powerful.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. Since I started doing these interviews, one of the most requested guests has been Gabe Valdivia. He was an early designer at Facebook, and he's led design for a bunch of different startups since then, most recently as the head of design for Patreon. But in the last year, he's made a pretty big shift where he's decided to work for himself, venture out on his own, and position himself as a fractional design partner for early stage teams. So a lot of this conversation gets into the weeds about what it's like to design 0-to-1 experiences. We talk about different strategies for speed, storytelling, prototyping, and a lot more. But first, I wanted to go back in time so we can hear more about Gabe's design journey and everything that led up to him making the decision to take the leap and work for himself.
Well, there's different archetypes for how people get into design. They're like the Neopets people. They're the Mac forums people. I am part of the people that got into it through music and band posters. In ninth grade, I joined a school where you had to pick a major, and I haven't stopped designing since. So it's basically the only thing I know how to do. And along that journey, the iPhone came out and kind of made me notice Silicon Valley and startups. And, you know, the options growing up were like, I could either work for like some sort of corporate job or buy a hoodie and go to this office that has ball pits and ping pong tables, and they're just doing things their way and they're getting away with it. You know, they're coming up with these apps that everyone's downloading, and the phone and all these things are emerging. I thought that is aligned with like that spirit of rebellion that I got excited about. Very early in my career, I kind of focused on moving to Silicon Valley and being a part of that spirit. I joined a small startup a decade ago. Was a very quintessential startup experience, like a small office on Market Street in San Francisco. The startup was called Automatic. We shipped a device that got a bit of notoriety and put me on the radar of the people at Facebook at that time who recruited me, and I joined Facebook in 2013. And that was a really formative experience for me, Facebook and that whole ethos. I spent a long time there. I worked on a bunch of different projects. From there, I went to Google, and then back to startups. And I think, especially recently, I've started reflecting on my experience so far and what I enjoyed about that experience and didn't. And the one constant across all the jobs that I've had have been that I've always gravitated towards small teams that are kind of emerging. Whether even within a big company like Facebook or Google, I always worked on kind of skunk works teams that had something to prove. Startup within a big tech company. That was my entire experience, always. I recently had a kid, as you know, and there's a lot of self-reflection that comes in those 9 months. Ironically, a lot of clarity that comes after the kid comes to your world. And for me, I thought that, you know, the thing that made most sense was to focus on those early stage teams, that early stage energy, and use my skills, which, you know, in part have been shaped by those experiences. Like, I'm very good at the things that those companies need at that stage, not very good at the things that companies need at later stages. So kind of aiming those skills towards that stage, decided to kind of take the step to leave my full-time job and start my own practice, focused specifically on early stage teams and helping them go from 0-to-1, from just an idea, a vague concept, to a tangible product that they can react to, and more importantly, their audience or their users can react to.
I want to talk a little bit more about this 0-to-1 phase of a product's life cycle. Maybe you could share a bit about what makes that unique, but specifically how it impacts what you bring to the table as a designer.
Yeah, I think the most unique part that resonates with you the most is the sense of urgency that is not manufactured, right? It's like a sense of survival. So that sense of urgency, to me, is really contagious, and it gives you a purpose or a meaning for showing up and doing things. I think there are different ways of approaching that My favorite way is actually kind of counterintuitive to what you hear from most designers out there, which is this idea of breadth versus depth. I love exploring, going really wide on an idea and arriving at the good solutions only after you've explored all the bad solutions. And that to me feels like, in order to do that in a high urgency environment, you need to get really good at being fast and being kind of in domain of your skill sets as a designer, of the techniques, the actual like dexterity that you have to take an idea from abstract to concrete. So I think it's challenging to do that, and I gravitate towards that challenge. I think this is true in all contexts, but specifically, I think in the early stage context, design is most valuable when it is artifact first, where you know you lead with an artifact. Any idea, you create a prototype or a visual of some kind that makes it real. The team stops thinking about a kind of abstract concept and reacting to a tangible artifact. So I think, you know, that is really key for this early stage. And it becomes less necessary as the company scales up, right? It's more about frameworks and alignments and kind of these exercises or activities to actually come together. I believe that even in that context, being artifact first is the best way to do it, but it is less, I think, urgent and less obvious in that environment.
I like that take because it is a little bit different than what I would typically hear, especially in remote first environments where, you know, you have like writing cultures are becoming a really big thing, where it's like, you know, design's role is to basically get alignment maybe in a Notion doc before they even show anything visual. So it is kind of different. I'd like to go a little bit deeper on that method and way of working. And maybe you could even talk about how you find the right problems to solve in an artifact first world, because there is more of a time investment to create an artifact for an idea versus just to start a conversation in a simple Slack message or a Notion doc. How do you make sure that you are finding the right problems to solve versus being a little bit more reactive and then creating your prototype?
I think the goal here is to communicate an idea with as little ambiguity as possible. And you know, this may be colored by the fact that I spent 3 years at Patreon before going independent, but I do believe today that designers are content creators. And as content creators, one of your main tasks is to tell a story in a format that is compelling to an audience. Sometimes that format is a document. If the audience likes to read a lot, I have friends who worked at Substack. I think that team is very, you know, like literary forward, and I imagine documents are very powerful in that environment. I worked at Google, where documents are also very powerful in that environment. But I think it depends on your team makeup, and a different artifact, different kind of artifact might be more effective. And I think if you look at the broader media landscape, there's a reason why video is so engaging and so powerful. More importantly, short form video is so powerful. I don't think, you know, sharing ideas within a team is any different. You can, like, I think the best designers are probably like TikTok creators within their own company who can create an idea that's sticky and really engaging in a way that's really powerful. Someone who's probably the best that I've seen do this is Alex Cornell.
And you're going to say Alex.
Yeah, he creates these like artifacts that are so powerful and so sticky. They're funny, they're high production value, they're meaningful, and they're good ideas packaged in a way that are so powerful. So I think that is a big part of being a designer, is recognizing what is the right format and having the skills to communicate your idea in that format.
I love the idea of thinking of designers as content creators, because something I've been thinking about recently is, as designers, we often just assume that, well, yeah, of course someone's going to watch my video. Of course someone's going to read what I wrote and actually give me attention. But it's not true. Like, even in your own company, it's not necessarily true. And so, like, using this lens of, how would I write this if it was on Twitter? Because then you have to write something that is engaging, that actually calls someone's attention and makes them want to click and give it the time of day. And I think that's an interesting framework that you could use, maybe for like portfolio projects, internal memos, whatever you're sharing, is like, yeah, you're a storyteller. Like, you have to be engaging in everything that you are putting out there. And you can't just assume that just because you're the designer, someone's going to give you their full attention. So I like that idea.
Yeah. And if you pair that with humility, right? Every time your idea doesn't get consumed in the way that you intended, that's an opportunity to learn. So you could try a video and that didn't work out. Okay, let's try an interactive prototype. Okay, that didn't work out. And you keep iterating until you find that right way.
I want to pull on this storytelling thread a little bit more, because I have seen you write about the importance of storytelling. And at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter how good your designs are. Like, your ability to tell an effective story is what's going to lead to the outcome that you want, whether it's getting your video watched or even landing like that next role. So maybe we could use this opportunity to talk a little bit about how you've grown as a storyteller over the years.
I think my answer to that is going to be similar to the answer to many questions you might ask, which is practice. Just do as many things as you can, as much as you can. I've done this for a minute now, and I've had my own podcast. I hosted a conference. I have done a lot of public speaking. I have written a lot of stuff. All of that is probably mediocre at best, but it is an attempt for me to practice and get better at storytelling. When I see designers who have their own podcast or have their own, you know, TikTok series or whatever it is, that to me gives me a signal that they're interested in practicing and putting themselves out there and getting better at their craft. And I honestly, that's the only way I know to get better at something, is to do it as much as possible.
I want to push on it a little bit more. You've put in all these reps, you've practiced. If you were to go back and look at who you were as a storyteller much earlier in your career, maybe even early Facebook, what were some of the gaps or ways that you have since leveled up as a result of all of that practice?
Yeah, it's probably the taste, right? I've developed a better sense of taste now than I had then. I think I'm more aware now of a broader pantheon of designers or creators who influence what my first step is. So I would, if I were to go back, I would put more effort into finding reference points that show me what good storytelling is. Today, I spend a lot of time consuming content from comedians. I love film. I love reading. All of that influences what I can do as a designer. And maybe in the past, I thought of those as like separate worlds, where now I feel like there's more overlap between those worlds. And I feel more comfortable pulling a technique that I see a filmmaker do into a all-hands presentation for a corporate design work. You know, like, if you really kind of like blend those worlds together, I think you can get better at that storytelling bit.
It's interesting you say comedians, because I was listening to a My First Million podcast the other day, and Sean Puri said the exact same thing. He's like, if you want to get better at storytelling, watch a comedian, because they're the people that have to refine their craft the most and really understand this idea of withholding and tension and revealing at the right moment. So that's just another plus one in my book. I'd like to kind of turn back to your process and the way that you're working with different clients now that you've ventured off and you're working as an independent. Because one of the things that I noticed is you're currently like working, I think, with like four different AI clients. So everything's like super, super new. My question is, how are you able to ramp up quickly on a new problem space?
I think that there's something really liberating about trusting the design process and trusting why you are in the room as a designer. You know, I've been in the same room as people who are way smarter than I am, way more capable in every sense of the word, yet they can't do what I can do. And I think that's really empowering, right? Every designer has something to bring to the table that is different than what the rest of the room has to bring. I think of it that way, of coming into a room and kind of silencing my imposter syndrome and all my insecurities with the voice that says, hey, you're good at this thing. You know how to do this thing. You've been doing it for a while. Just bring that to the table, and you can talk to a rocket scientist. You can talk to a neurosurgeon. You can talk to anyone who on paper could seem intimidating. I think you can contribute something. My next step from that is usually helping the team articulate in layman's terms, like why we're doing what we're doing. Kind of like that, those scenes of movies, you know, where the scientist is saying something and then some their friend is next to them, they're like, okay, now say in English. That's kind of what I do. Or like, you know, when in your company environment, there's a lot of assumptions that you make, and you're really deep into like why what you're doing is important and all the steps beyond that. So I like to come in and literally play the dumb card and say, hey, I don't really know what that means. Can you explain that to me? And why are we doing this? Like, what is the problem here that we're solving? Yeah, but that's not really a problem. Like, how would your mom articulate that problem? How would this person articulate that problem? Like, I find that it's easy to get to that corporate jargon speak where like, we need to do this and that. But really, you need to make something that is tangible or like digestible to anyone on the street. So I like to like kind of ground everyone in that truth. And more often than not, people don't know how to get there. And that's where design comes in. You help them arrive at articulation of the problem. So I think that to me, those are two techniques that I use to kind of ramp up in a new space. Like, I'm not a prompt engineer or machine learning expert. That's not my world, but I can sit next to a machine learning expert and together we can craft a problem statement and I can bring design to augment what that person is doing. And I could do that with any other expert, knowing that, you know, it's not really my skill set that I'm bringing to the table. It's this knowledge of design as a process, almost like the scientific process, where if you apply that process into any area, you can make progress.
I've led design for many startups over the last like 10 plus years. And a pretty common experience that I've had, I know others have had, is you're working in this small team environment and you have founders and leaders with very strong opinions. And really what they want is for you to just execute against those opinions. So could you talk a little bit about how you collaborate and like really build rapport with founders specifically, but also how you as a designer help a young company establish vision?
I've heard a lot of people push back against the idea of being a pixel pusher, that, you know, they want to have a seat at the table and think about the strategy and contribute to the larger picture. I am a staunch believer that the best way to have strategic impact is to push pixels. So I would very happily be your hired gun and I'll execute your idea. Like, I love designing. That's the fun part. Like, put me in front of Figma, put me in front of Origami, and I'll make a wonderful prototype of your idea. Now, is it a good idea? We'll find out, right? And it could be great, and therefore we keep going. Or more likely than not, it is a bad idea. Or there's some parts of the idea that are bad. So now we have the breathing room because we kind of like scratched that itch. Now we can sit back and be like, huh, something is not right there. How can we make it right? I think that's where you come in and can influence the more strategic discussions. But I have no qualms on executing your ideas, anybody's ideas. I love designing. It's like my favorite thing to do. I love coming in and rolling up my sleeves and designing anything, whatever you want it to be, like a business card, a bathroom sign, a VR prototype. We can do all the above. And then we'll find if the ideas are good or bad.
So I'm going to kind of restate that back just to make sure that I get it, because it is a cool take, which is basically like, maybe you even have a gut sense that a certain idea isn't going to work. But instead of pushing back and trying to drive alignment really early in the process, maybe in a doc, you're just like, yeah, screw it. Let's just build it, ship it, get feedback, and iterate from there. Would you agree with that?
Some way. I think you can arrive at validation before you ship and iterate an idea. And that's where the artifact comes in, right? The right artifact comes in. You can create a prototype that is high fidelity enough that feels real, and you can then validate it without going through the cycles of engineering and arrive at the conclusion of whether it's a good idea or a bad idea way faster than you would, you know, if you implement it with your engineering team. The secret sauce is like, can you visualize or like bring that idea to life quickly for other people to be able to understand what you're trying to communicate? I think that's where the Facebook kind of upbringing comes in, where there was a lot of work being done there to create really high fidelity prototypes really quickly to validate ideas. So I think that paired up with that artifact first mentality allows us to, you know, get out of the abstract land of like, should we do this? Should we do that? Let's do this and that. And let's do both at a high fidelity and then react.
You mentioned Origami, which makes sense given the Facebook background. Can you talk a little bit about when you reach for Figma versus when you reach for Origami?
Yeah, it's changed a lot over the last few years. Before Facebook, I was doing a lot of prototyping on Keynote, actually. That was when Magic Move was actually magic. Now we have Smart Animate on Figma that made it mainstream. But yeah, I went from Keynote to Origami. I worked in VR for many years, so I had to get my hands dirty in Unity. I find that Figma has gotten really good at prototyping, like, good enough ideas, and Origami becomes the tool for very specific, you know, use cases. Maybe like you're dealing with like a map for location data, or maybe you're dealing with like, you know, native inputs, like you need a camera and you have to have like more in-depth interactions like that. Or you have gotten the design to a point where you can focus on the micro interactions. Like, you know, Figma still hasn't shipped like scroll-based interactions or like different triggers for your prototype. So you might want to jump into a tool like Origami for that to really like get that to the next level. But Figma has become the tool for most of it right now.
Yeah, it makes sense. I haven't hopped into like a Principle or Protopie in a long time, which I used to use for the majority of my prototyping. So it's kind of interesting to see that macro trend. I want to ask a little bit more about your kind of 0 to 1 process and workflow, because it's very interesting to me. And I think I want to even frame it by saying that as someone who has also went 0 to 1, you know, quite a few times, and it just kind of goes hand in hand with working with startups, each time I start over on this process, I'm tweaking little things and finding little improvements and ways that I can improve my own process. And so when you reflect on your own journey as someone who has went through that process a few times now, what are some of the ways that your workflow has evolved or matured, or just different ways that you're even viewing your role as a designer?
Yeah, so I think now my role is as an accelerator and a simplifier. The world has gotten really complex and really slow, and starting something is, you know, there's so many obstacles to get to gaining momentum on something. Often logistical obstacles, you know, there's a lot of things that will slow you down. So I think for me, what I can bring to the table, and I think this is true of most designers as well, is to help people move faster and help people arrive at a simpler solution. I think editing is easier than creating. So it's much easier to look at something and either trim it down or make it slightly better than it is to start from scratch. So it's often that first start that is really hard. For me, it could be as simple as like open Figma and create white rectangles for each step of the flow. And now they're just white. Okay, second step, write down a couple lines per white rectangle. So you're editing over what you made, right? Now you have a couple of lines of text, put a gray rectangle around those boxes. Okay, cool, now that's a button. And then you keep going, and now you're kind of like, you know, you're not creating an interface, you're just kind of slowly adding to the thing that you created before. And I think that helps the team get this sense of momentum, right? I think that paired up with the idea of sharing as much as possible, as quickly as possible, then now people get this influx of creativity, right? Every step of the way, there's a new Slack comment, there's a new post, there's a new campsite update. There's something new that helps people understand, okay, we're making progress. We're better now than we were yesterday. And that sense of momentum is really infectious.
I like the example of just creating the white rectangles as a way to get momentum. Maybe we could talk a little bit more about that, just to see if there's other tactics that you're using, because something that I've been thinking a lot about is just the different ways that designers collapse complexity in the very early stages of a project when things are super ambiguous. When you're just getting handed that new, whatever it is, brief, or you're starting to work on a new project, what are some of the ways that you take this, you know, really ambiguous, meaty problem space and bring it towards that place of simplification?
I had a college teacher who had this saying. I don't know if he came up with it, but he used to say, there are no dumb questions. There's only dumb people, and dumb people don't ask questions. I like to ask dumb questions and get to that kind of nugget of what we're trying to do. With every answer, I try to visualize it into something more than a line of text. One of my favorite creators is Van Neistat, who's the brother of Casey Neistat, who's a famous YouTuber. He has a video where he talks about this spectrum of perfection and how at one end of the spectrum you have something that's good enough, and on the other end of the spectrum you have something that's perfect, and in the middle you have something that's excellent. And there are people who wait a long time until what they're creating is excellent before they share it, right? They want to share something excellent, so they wait a long time and iterate a long time on it. Then once you get to that point where they believe is excellent, they share it. I am much more of the good enough type of creator or designer, where as soon as something is good enough, I share it. And the hope is that the more good enough things you share, the closer you'll get to excellent.
I like how often things come back to momentum and speed. And on your website, you make a point to talk about how you're able to work really quickly as a designer. So are there other tactics or strategies or anything else that you've refined that allows you to work more fast as a designer?
I think working in systems makes me work much faster. I've worked with designers who organize their files in a way that is like mind-numbing to me. Like, I am auto layout for everything all the time, components for everything all the time, name all my layers. That helps me have a tidy workshop to then revisit once I inevitably get it wrong and need to like do an iteration, right? I think of every design as like a sense of maybe like a universe of tools and rules that I'm setting up that should be internally consistent, so that when I need to revisit them, I can understand that language that I'm setting up. So for me, it's important to like be as tidy as possible. That doesn't mean that the canvas itself is tidy. There's going to be a lot of iterations, but the components should be, you know, reusable, so that I can then kind of take those out of that context and put them in a different context. That may be another thing that I do that helps me move fast, whereas like a little bit of investment in at the beginning to make them reusable, so that revision 2, 5, 10, 15 from there, I don't have to redo it.
I have a big smile on my face because I don't think you hear that very often, especially from designers who are working in that early stage. It's very much so like, no, you can't name your layers, no components, groups over frames, you know? And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, you described the white boxes in your process. I will draw the white box and I will turn that into a component before I have anything in it, just so that I don't have to change it twice. I never want to have to change anything twice. So it's interesting to hear you talk about relying on components, even though you are inheriting these really early stage bodies of work.
Yeah, I think maybe people react to that as like being somewhat elitist, or, you know, they hear a statement like that and they look at their own files and they're like, oh, my file looks like shit. I must be a bad designer. So then they feel the need of saying, you know, you don't need to do that. You can be a designer, have a shitty file, and still you'll have a job, which, you know, more power to them. I take joy in the organization of the file. Like, that to me is part of the fun of being a designer, is, you know, tidying it up. Like, I love tidying my desk. I love tidying my house. It's what I get joy out of. If there's any logic behind it, like actual, like, you know, now with variables and origami, that is a big part of origami, where you set up these like internally consistent systems that itself are beautiful. You know, just like how you set up this prototype, that can give you a sense of pride that I find like it's like a worthy carrot to chase.
You talked about the importance of good enough. When you're working on a new project, again, in that 0 to 1 frame, how do you think about where that line of good enough lives? And maybe there are even certain things that you find typically fall on the other side of that line for you.
It comes back to speed. You know, I think you should be able to share an update on the work every day, every other day, definitely every week. So if it takes you 2 weeks to come back with a prototype, that's too slow. Like, you should have shared a napkin sketch, you know? So I think you can give yourself the luxury of creating a higher fidelity prototype or artifact if you have become fast enough to do that. If not, then give me a wireframe, right? Like, I need to be reacting to something often and bringing people along with me often. Otherwise, I'm not ready to focus on origami prototypes. I'm just not fast enough. I'm not ready. I gotta go back to practicing on my own until I'm ready to bring that to my professional world. So that to me is like the cost of doing something high fidelity. If I can make a perfect prototype, you know, within 30 minutes, I'd do that. That's the goal.
That's really cool, actually. I frequently hear designers anchoring on the fidelity level, but that's irrelevant. You should anchor on the speed, because if you can crank out high fidelity in the same time it takes for someone else to make a wireframe, then what's stopping you? I like that a lot. You've talked a little bit now, a couple times, about just frequency of sharing with the team and bringing back these artifacts. I've seen you specifically mention the async video with the voiceover, which is so, so important, especially in the post-COVID world. And like, it's a skill that is kind of expected of a lot of designers, and yet nobody ever really taught me it. There's not a lot of resources for how to do it well. So can you talk a little bit about any like strategies or tactics that you use to improve the quality or share your ideas effectively in an async video?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There are very tactical things where I always share a prototype. Never or very rarely do I pan and zoom through a Figma file. I think that's really disorienting. And it, for someone who's not Figma literate or design literate, can be really hard to understand. So share a prototype. Ideally share a story behind that prototype. You know, like, I'm trying to do X, this is how I would do it. Or think of that moment, that Loom video, as a opportunity to tell a story. That's like, that's your time to shine. Those 2-3 minutes, that's you're on the stage, spotlight is on you. You gotta entertain your audience. So like, drop a couple jokes in there, make your content engaging somehow, put a cliffhanger in the first 10 seconds that you pay off 2 minutes later, right? Like, you need to understand, just like YouTubers and TikTokers, etc., that people have better shit to do than to watch your video. So like, think of strategies and techniques to hook them so that they watch the whole thing. And I'm a nerd. Like, I love posting a Loom and then get a notification that somebody watched it, and then notification that somebody commented. And I think, just like people obsess over how their videos are performing on YouTube, you can obsess over how people are consuming your stories within your team.
I like that. And I like that you referenced TikTok again. Something that it just made me think of as a way to make this practical is even to recognize when I'm finding myself hooked or really intrigued by a video. Like, if I'm scrolling through TikTok or whatever, what hooked me? And then can I abstract that out to add it as something that I could use in my own tool belt to just get people excited about what I'm about to say and create this curiosity gap for me to fill?
Yeah, one thing I would say, though, is this is more important the bigger your team is and the more mature the team, the product is. This is one of the benefits of working at an early stage environment, is that people are interested and they will watch your 12-minute Loom rant because they care about it, right? So the challenges of sharing your video in a small team are much lower than sharing a video, you know, in the AI team at Facebook. You know, there's a lot more opinions there, a lot more cooks in the kitchen. So I think, you know, you can pick your environment too that fits your approach.
I want to zoom out for a second because, you know, you've been designing for forever now, since ninth grade. Yeah. And you've only recently made this switch from working in-house to now being independent. I'd like to kind of talk about, like, what are some of the main ways that your day-to-day has evolved and the different responsibilities that you are owning as a designer now that you are working for yourself versus in-house?
One big difference I noticed is that working in-house is a more indirect correlation between your input and your output. Let's say I work at a company and I kind of slack off for a month. I work really hard the other month, and then I work average the following month. All those 3 months, you get paid the exact same. You probably get an average of that for your performance review. You know, the output ends up being very consistent, regardless of what the input is. And I found that to be actually quite numbing. At times, I put in a lot of energy into my job and got the same output as when I didn't put a lot of energy into it. And today, I feel like, you know, it's the opposite is true, where if I don't work a lot 1 month, I don't get paid a lot. And if I work a lot, then I do get paid a lot, which sounds silly to say, but it is actually quite powerful, because you are in control of that throttle. And not only are you in control of it, you feel the impact of your work more closely, more directly. I found that to be really empowering, where I can now be design how much I want to, how much energy I want to give my job, and I can predict what energy I want to get back from it. You know, very tactically, there's, you know, things that I just chose not to give my energy to. Like, I don't go to any offsites. I don't sit in any all hands. I don't go to any stand-up meetings, no one-on-ones where we talk about the weekend. All that stuff for me was energy draining. That's just me kind of going through the motions of the in-house job, where right now the interactions I have with my clients are very much where I can bring in value, which is, you know, sitting in a conference room with a founder and a whiteboard. Let's solve this problem together. Let me present a design idea to you. Let me unblock this this thing that we're stuck on. I can make sure that those are the interactions that I have, the folks that I work with. And that to me gives me a ton of energy. Those are like my favorite parts of working. It's like those creative breakthroughs that I get so excited about. And they get to see the best parts of me, the ones where I'm most valuable and most impactful. So that's one thing that I've really kind of appreciated of this model, where you can select what gives you energy and what doesn't and focus there. There might be people who love all hands. I think they're one of the most excruciating things to sit through. So I think that's really empowering, right? And it kind of gives you the gift of self-awareness. You know, what do you enjoy? What are you good at? And that is the thing that you are selling, right, to different clients. Whereas, like, I found that within an in-house environment, I have often shielded myself from the company or the product. Like, working at Facebook has a social status. Like, there's a lot that comes with it that is independent of you that you get to benefit from, right? You're like, I work at this company does these things, therefore I do these things, right? And you get to handpick the ones that you like and the ones that you don't. And you can do that forever, for your entire career. And there's something safe and comforting about that. But I much prefer this other approach, where I am much more in tune with the output of what I put into the work.
I read an article recently that you wrote where you talked about the difference between a product planner and a product designer. Can you unpack that a little bit and maybe share how you've moved across that spectrum now that you are working independent versus in-house?
It's an article I wrote to explore a thought that may not be true, but I thought it was worth exploring. And that distinction didn't come from me. It came from a friend who chose to remain anonymous to avoid the Twitter drama. Well, we're having this conversation and he made the analogy between an urban planner versus an urban designer and how the work that we end up doing in-house, a lot of it is not design work, meaning it is not work where you employ design skills. It is work that designers do, but it is not necessarily design work. And, you know, you can get into the semantics discussion there. But I found that, you know, a big part of working, especially at larger companies, is, you know, you do some design thinking and that ends up being the minority of the time investment that you have on the company. You have to do everything I mentioned around all hands and one-on-ones, etc. But you also have to do a lot of like alignment and a lot of politicking, and you're subject to this broader machine. And I think the result of that is that designers are kind of reverse engineering a definition for design based on their experiences in-house. They're like, okay, well, what designers do is they just go to meetings all day. Therefore, design is going to meetings all day. There is another path, which is to focus on what you get energy from. In my case, I get the energy from creating. And I connect that to design. To me, those are hand in hand. And I talked a lot about being artifact first. And to me, that is the reason I got into design for. Like, I didn't, you know, I wasn't growing up thinking about design as like, oh yeah, you'll sit in meetings with a bunch of executives and you'll arrive at a solution that is worse than what you started on, but everyone's kind of okay with. That's not what gave me energy to pursue this career. I think the thing that I hold on to is that creative breakthrough of like being in an ambiguous place and then arriving at somewhere that's concrete, that feels like it's solving a problem and it is marketing to an audience. So to me, there's been a bit of like a dilution of what it means to be a designer as we get embedded into these companies that are not design companies, and we end up doing a lot of work that is not design work. And I found the juxtaposition between my experience working in-house over the last decade and now independently to be quite jarring. It almost feels like two different jobs.
The word dilution is really interesting, especially because, you know, we're being inundated with this idea of like the flattening of the stack. And I think a lot of designers are feeling like it's not enough to just do design anymore. You got to figure out how to be like a product manager, or, you know, learn front end or develop like business acumen. And listening to you talk, it's almost like you're like a design purist in a way. Like you really, like you said, get energy from like the creation, the organizing of the files, the prototyping, the bringing ideas to life. How do you think about this flattening of the stack and the, you know, almost like the impending, I'm trying not to use the word AI, but like a lot of that is the tipping point, right? Like that is the tipping point. I think a lot of people are slightly nervous about what what we will be considering the role of designer moving forward.
I don't know of a single experienced designer who works at a company in-house who is energized by their work. They've all arrived at some sort of, you know, trade-off analysis, and they're like, yeah, it's good enough. And I think to me, that's an indication that, you know, design might not be necessary as a full-time role within those companies, because they end up, you know, they end up doing less than they're capable of, kind of parking in those companies and getting only a subset of what their output could be. And that subset is usually enough for that company, right? I've shifted my career to focus on early stage companies, but the other part of the shift has been to function on a fractional level, where I work with many clients at once and they get a portion, you know, a fraction of my attention. And my argument is that that fraction is more than enough than they need. They don't need my full attention. It would be more costly than is necessary. And I think, you know, I don't know if that's true of everyone, but I find that it works really well for me. And there could be a world where designers are not embedded within their companies in-house, and instead they serve multiple clients, companies, or teams, and they kind of get kind of deployed when the company needs or the team needs design thinking, and then retract it when they don't. I think that's possible, especially with the advent of AI, where, you know, all these roles are becoming redundant. And I think that's a good thing. I think that there's going to be more designers working on more things rather than designers part within a single company for a decade. I like to embrace that and think that there is a potentially better future where, as a designer, you get to work on more problems at once in slightly different ways. And I personally think that's a more exciting way to work than focusing on a single problem for 10 years. So I'm excited about that future.
Before I let you go, I want to ask a couple of quick personal questions that I like to kind of just ask everyone as a sample. What's something that you believe about design that you think a lot of other designers might disagree with?
I think the traditional triad is at risk as well. This idea of like engineer, product manager, and a designer paired together to work on something. I think that is an archaic idea, and the newer companies are challenging that notion. Companies like the browser company, they have product engineers, right? We've heard about design engineers and prototypers, like blending of those lines that in turn, I think over time will obviate one or a couple of those roles, whether it's designers or engineers or product managers. I think the atomic unit is going to be different 10 years from now than it is today, probably smaller than it is today, which I find all this exciting. I gravitate towards change. I'm an immigrant. I've moved a lot in my life. I deeply believe that the status quo is not what it needs to be, and there will be pretty seismic changes over the next 10 years. And I find that really exciting. I find that really energizing. If you told me that 10 years from now, we're going to be doing the same thing that we're doing right now, that makes me sad. Like, I don't want to be like, you know, doing those things. So I think design industry will look differently in 5-10 years than it does today. And it will likely mean that designers need to change, period, but also change how they relate with companies, what tools they use, what their role is, will evolve. I'm excited about that.
Well, Gabe, this has been amazing. You've given us a ton to think about. I got all my notes over here, and I'm going to just kind of go through things because I think your perspective is fresh. Like it really is fresh, and you have a lot of unique takes that I think are actionable. So thank you for taking the time to come and share them with us today.
Thank you, man. I'm a big fan of you and the podcast, so I'm flattered you have me over.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, each week I send an email to over 10,000 designers with featured resources and key insights that you can use to take a leap forward in your career. Head to dive.club/email if you want to sign up. I'll see you next week.